Good morning. A star witness in the Watergate hearings testifies before Congress again today. House Democrats called John Dean as they consider impeachment proceedings for the current president. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. So how does Mexico plan to secure its own southern border? I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We hear from a reporter who's watching how Mexico handles arriving migrants now. Also, how is getting a defend itself? We question an American representative of the Chinese tech company under pressure from the U.S. It is Monday, June 10th, the day when a ceasefire took effect in the Middle East. It stopped the six-day war in 1967, though a final peace has yet to come after Israel captured East Jerusalem and much territory besides. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump is warning Mexico that even though there's a new accord on migration with the U.S., he could still impose tariffs on Mexican goods. He says he doesn't think that's necessary. Although tariffs are paid for by Americans and American firms, Trump tweeted that they are profitable. It appears Hong Kong will move forward with changes to its extradition laws involving mainland China, despite yesterday's large protests. NPR's Rob Schmitz has more.
The mass demonstration was one of the largest in Hong Kong's history, a stunning display of resistance to China's Communist Party and its efforts to erode civil liberties that have long set the former British colony apart from the rest of the country. Organizers say they counted more than a million people on the streets, nearly one in seven Hong Kong residents. What looked like a river of people stretched more than a mile along a downtown thoroughfare. They marched to protest a legislative proposal that would allow extradition of city residents to mainland China. People are worried Chinese authorities would use the law to send dissidents, activists, and foreigners to face trial in mainland courts, which are controlled by the Communist Party and don't offer the rights historically extended to Hong Kong residents. Despite the record numbers, neither Beijing nor Hong Kong's government showed any willingness to back down. And a second reading of the bill is scheduled for Wednesday. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Shanghai.
One person was killed Sunday when a construction crane collapsed into a nearby residential building in Dallas. Officials say it went down in a strong storm. Five other people were hurt, two critically. The spokesman for Dallas Fire and Rescue, Jason Evans, says damage to the building is substantial.
The building itself has suffered multiple collapses in different areas of the building to include residential spaces as well as the parking garage.
Officials will investigate the collapse of the crane. The storm that buffeted the crane felled big trees in Dallas and knocked out power. Under a budget deal reached Sunday night, California would become the first state in the nation to extend health benefits to some undocumented adults. From member station KQED, Katie Orr has more.
As the Trump administration looks to crack down on undocumented immigrants, California is taking a different approach. Democratic lawmakers and Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom have reached a deal that would extend the state's version of Medicaid to eligible undocumented adults between the ages of 19 and 25. The agreement doesn't go as far as some lawmakers would have liked. They wanted to include undocumented seniors as well. State officials estimate the expansion of the low-income health plan will cover about 90,000 people at a cost of $98 million a year. The deal was approved by a state budget conference committee. It will be voted on by the full legislature later this week, but is expected to pass. For NPR News, I'm Katie Orr in Sacramento.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Broadway's highest honors, the 73rd annual Tony Awards, were handed out at Radio City Music Hall in New York on Sunday night. Jeff London reports.
Hadestown, a soulful rendering of the Orpheus myth, was the biggest winner of the night. It took eight awards, including Best Musical. Anais Mitchell won for Best Score, and she said she learned three things about writing a musical, which also apply to making change in the world.
Number one, nobody does it alone. And number two, it takes a long time. And number three, it is worth it. So thank you.
The Ferryman, a sprawling play about Northern Ireland during the Troubles, took 4 awards, including Best Play. Revivals of Oklahoma and The Boys in the Band won in their categories. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
There are 2 matchups today at the Women's World Cup in France. Argentina will face Japan. Japan won the Cup in 2011 and made it to the final 4 years ago, but lost to the U.S. The second match today is between Cameroon and Canada. In men's pro hockey, there will be a Game 7 in the Stanley Cup Final. Boston defeated St. Louis last night 5-1 to even the series at 3 games apiece. Game 7 is Wednesday night in Boston. Meanwhile, in pro basketball, Game 5 of the NBA Championships is tonight in Toronto between the Raptors and the Golden State Warriors. Toronto leads the series 3-1. If they win tonight, the Canadian team will take the NBA Championship. It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio, and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Good morning. In 1973, John Dean was the star witness in the Watergate hearings. Now, 40 years later, then some, Dean will return to Capitol Hill to testify before a different Congress about a different president. Dean's testimony all those years ago helped lead to Nixon's resignation. Now, Democrats are hoping his insights into the Mueller report will boost their case against President Trump. In a tweet last night, President Trump called Dean a, quote, sleazebag attorney, and he repeated his claim that Democrats are just looking for a do-over on the Mueller report. Among those doing the questioning of Dean today will be Congressman Steve Cohen. He's a Democrat from the state of Tennessee and a member of the House Judiciary Committee. He is in our studio this morning. Thanks so much for coming in.
Rachel, good to be here from my hometown of Memphis.
Memphis, Tennessee. All right, Congressman, what are you hoping to learn today from John Dean?
How the Nixon obstruction of justice charges parallel the charges that Mueller suggests in his special counsel report, and other parallels there might be that he sees as a student of abhorrent presidential conduct, unconstitutional conduct. And we also have 2 prosecutors, Ms. Vance and Barbara, I think it's McQuaid, and they have knowledge, too, and their understanding of what the Mueller's suggestions, 10 or 12 suggestions of possible obstruction of justice and how they see those falling within the legal standards.
May I ask for slightly more specifics on that? I mean, what does it matter what John Dean thinks about the Mueller report? He was the key witness, yes, in the Watergate hearings, but that was a completely different scenario, completely different set of facts.
Well, it was a different set of facts, but it was the same activities. Nixon, really the thing that got him was obstructing justice. And of course, the obstructing justice that I think he was most guilty of was not giving over documents to Congress, which this administration is doing also. That's not in the Mueller report. But we've been stymied at getting witnesses that would be the best witnesses. The president's attorney, Mr. McCain, the president's other attorney, who sometimes goes by the name of Attorney General, Bill Barr, Hope Hicks, and there's another lady that was refused to come. And so the president's told people not to come, to abide by subpoenas. They have done what the president's asked them to do. Mr. Mueller we'd like to have, and he's been reticent. He may come eventually. But rather than just wait on these people, because time, as Mick Jagger would say, is on my side, time is not on my side. Time is on their side, and they're trying to run out the clock.
But at the same time, you just admit that the reason you're calling John Dean is because you can't get anyone who actually knows anything. I mean, we should point out some...
Well, John Dean knows a lot. He studied this, as has Ms. McQuaid and Ms. Vance. They've spent a lot of time researching and studying, and they're knowledgeable. They're not part of the special counsel's team that investigated, but they have knowledge of the law. They have knowledge of how it is applied to a president, and they have knowledge of the fact situation.
So this is an issue that, by all counts, this is not a unified issue when it comes to how Democrats perceive impeachment or whether to move forward. A recent NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll says only roughly 20% of Americans support the idea of impeachment hearings. Are you really representing what most Americans think here?
Well, I don't know when your poll was done. There was a time when it was 19% were in favor of it, and there were 30% that were in favor of an inquiry.
This was just a couple weeks ago.
Well, since the 2 weeks, it's changed. The last poll I saw said 41% were now in favor of impeachment, and that might have included the inquiry. Normally, they ask, do you favor impeachment, do you favor inquiry, or are you against it totally? And it was about 50-50 on impeachment and or inquiry, as it distinguished from not being for it at all. But regardless of that, I'm representing my district. My district is very much in favor of impeachment and support me in what I'm doing. And I believe the Democrats are indicated. Most polls I've seen are 77% for impeachment. The Democrats are a little more than 50% of the electorate, as Hillary Clinton got about 52% of the vote. If you take 77% of 52%, you get about 38%, which is a lot, which is right at the 41% that I mentioned.
We only have seconds left, but House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has made the argument that it's too early, that there is no point to opening impeachment proceedings going down that road unless there's overwhelming evidence that Republicans in the Senate would agree. What's your response to that?
I think it's worth having the hearings to point out the conduct of this president where he has obstructed justice, which is in the Mueller report. The Mueller report does not say no collusion, does not say no obstruction. To point that out and to talk about emoluments which he's violated. Just this past week, the family went on a multi-million dollar trip to Ireland to his golf course, where we paid his golf course for taking care of our folks. And I think that will raise the stakes. And if the Republicans in the Senate don't vote for it, I think the voters will raise up, and it's, even in red states, and vote against them because the proof is overwhelming, and they will be wrong in supporting the president, and they can go right down with him, just like Dan Kuykendall, one of my predecessors, did when he supported Nixon to the end.
Congressman Steve Cohen, Democrat of the state of Tennessee, thanks for your time, sir.
You're welcome, Rachel.
NPR's Tim Mack covers Congress and was listening in there. So, Tim, Congressman Cohen clearly thinks that there is a path for impeachment. What are you hearing from other members of the House Judiciary Committee in particular?
Well, you know, more than half of the Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee, about 13 out of its 22 members, have indicated they want impeachment proceedings to begin. I think both you and the congressman put the finger on the message of the day, which is that there's going to be this comparison made continuously between President Trump and President Nixon with this hearing with John Dean. I also kind of found it interesting about, what Congressman Cohen said about Mueller. He said, quote, he may come eventually. What's going to be really interesting over the next few weeks is how the House Judiciary Committee deals with, or they may subpoena, they may further negotiate with Mueller to get his testimony. That's going to be something I'm watching over the next little bit.
All right, NPR's Tim Mack. Thanks so much, Tim. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Most of the stories of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church focus on acts by priests. In some stories of sexual abuse, the alleged abusers are nuns. Some victims say we can't tell how widespread the problem may be because allegations against women have been treated differently. Laura Benshoff reports from member station WHYY, and we should note this story will be inappropriate for some audiences.
When Trish Cahill was 15, a nun 2 decades older offered to be her mentor. First, it was an invitation to play guitar during Mass. Then it was,
if you get an A on your report card, I'll take you down to the shore for a day. I mean, like, my parents didn't take me down to the shore for a day. It was fantastic. So I got an A on my report card.
Cahill grew up in an Irish Catholic family in northern New Jersey and went to Catholic school. She says the nun's kindness was flattering. But during one of those outings, she says the nun slipped something into her tea.
I passed out. I don't really know what happened that night. I mean, I do know what happened that night, but I was not conscious. I was not able to make a decision.
That was the first time the sister sexually assaulted her and the start of an abusive dynamic that would last for more than a decade. Now, in her late 60s, Cahill is sober after years of struggling with drugs and alcohol. In the friend's house where she's staying, she pulls out bags of pictures and slides, artifacts she now sees as evidence of abuse.
See how long my hair is? Because she told me she wanted me to wear my hair long. Wear these, get these glasses, don't hang around with this person. She just controlled my life. She controlled every facet of my life.
Though less known than sexual misconduct by priests, there are many documented cases of similar allegations against nuns. The watchdog group Bishop Accountability has compiled a list of about 100 religious sisters who've been credibly accused. But there's no official count, in part because big investigations into Catholic clergy tend to focus on male abusers. Last year's massive Pennsylvania grand jury report contained one passing reference to a sexually abusive nun. Mary Dispenza, with the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP, says when it was released, victims of nuns also came forward.
Survivors went looking to find their stories listed among those shared, and they weren't there. They've actually made calls to ask, why aren't there more stories? Can my story be counted?
Part of the issue is that their stories aren't counted the same way. Accusations against nuns, monks, and religious order priests are usually dealt with by their respective orders and not their local diocese. But survivors say their abusers all exploited the same religious authority. When Steve Tyson was 9 years old, he says a nun started molesting him at his Catholic school in Dubuque, Iowa. Here he is talking about that experience in a 2014 recording archived with SNAP.
She had me come over to her desk where she's sitting at, and she taught me how the Eskimos kiss by rubbing her nose against my nose. And then she later taught me how the Americans kissed. And then she taught me how the French kissed.
Today, Tyson says he kept quiet for more than 30 years because he couldn't reconcile what happened to him with Catholic teaching about nuns.
She belonged to those people that our parents and grandparents put on pedestals and that they could do no wrong.
After many decades, he did come forward, and the nun's religious order cooperated with an investigation that found his allegations credible but not provable. In Trish Cahill's case, the religious order of the nun who abused her substantiated her claims and paid Cahill $70,000 in an out-of-court settlement. Neither order would make the nuns available for interview. In the meantime, Cahill's started going to church sporadically, not a Catholic one, where she's able to talk openly about her experiences.
To say I was sexually abused by a nun without immediately the cloud of, you're a sinner, this was a lesbian relationship, you tempted her.
She says those were all stereotypes she had to overcome to bring her abuse to light. For NPR News, I'm Laura Benchoff in Philadelphia.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air...
There is nothing that I won't do to defend what's mine.
Damian Lewis plays a ruthless hedge fund owner in Showtime's Billions. He also played a Marine sergeant in the series Homeland, King Henry VIII in Wolf Hall, and Army Major Richard Winters in the HBO series Band of Brothers. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Campaign Monitor, an email marketing platform used by more than 250,000 customers, offering personalization tools like engagement segments and dynamic content. More at campaignmonitor.com. From LifeLock, LifeLock with Norton reminds consumers that cyber criminals can steal identities, sell personal information on the dark web, and even infect mobile devices with malware. Learn more at LifeLock.com. And from Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We've been talking with an American who works for Huawei. The Chinese tech company is under pressure by the United States. And we're hearing people with a foot in two worlds as the U.S. and China begin to pull apart. This man oversaw internet security for the U.S. government, then found himself on the other side as the U.S. called Huawei a potential tool of China.
Check one, two. Check one, two.
Our producer, Ashley Westerman, brought microphones to a building in Washington, which intrigued the man we'd come to meet.
I'm supposed to do an audio history of the museum, the sixth floor museum in Dallas.
Really?
I owe them
Andy Purdy, who is trim and bearded, served in several government jobs, including work for a committee that reinvestigated the Kennedy assassination. He was a federal prosecutor. Then he oversaw the government's internet security after 9/11.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a czar position, but yeah, I was the lead cybersecurity official for the U.S. government.
Later, this former cybersecurity official received an offer from Huawei. It's headquartered in Shenzhen, China's version of Silicon Valley. Did you have a moment of thinking, should I be doing this?
Well, I was recruited by John Suffolk, who's our global lead for cyber and privacy.
John Suffolk once had a top internet security job for the UK. He went to work for Huawei, so Purdy did.
And some people say, well, Andy, you're just a defender of Huawei or a defender of China. No, I'm a defender of the fact that we have to manage risk, we have to be serious so that we as a society and a people, we can take advantage of the technologies in a way that's secure.
When Purdy took the job at Huawei in 2012, some Western governments worried about buying communications equipment from a supplier in China, but they were letting Huawei sell. Even the U.S. did. Depending on where you live, a call you make today might pass through Huawei equipment. Security concerns seemed manageable until the Trump administration.
The United States has also been very clear with our security partners on the threat posed by Huawei and other Chinese telecom companies.
Vice President Mike Pence spoke this year at a security forum in Europe. The U.S. wants to keep Huawei out of all the countries it can. We glimpsed what's at stake when we visited China and toured a construction project. It was a Beijing office building, a cylinder of black glass.
Wow!
With an atrium reaching to the roof.
So the atrium is the height of the entire 200-meter building.
That whatever that large thing is that fell, that echo, that gives you a sense of the space.
On an office floor, we saw a white plastic box overhead. It will relay wireless data as part of the fifth-generation internet, or 5G.
So this box and this box, these are base stations built into the ceiling for 5G connectivity for whatever firm moves into this floor under construction.
That white box will soon be out of sight, covered by ceiling tiles. But without it, this would hardly be a modern building at all. Other 5G base stations will be inside every office in the skyscraper and in buildings around the world, not to mention subways and roadways. They will carry 5G signals not just to phones, but to self-driving vehicles, appliances, and more. To Vice President Pence, boxes made by Huawei are potential arms of China's government.
As Chinese law requires them to provide Beijing's vast security apparatus with access to any data that touches their network or equipment.
Suddenly, Andy Purdy, representing Huawei in Washington, has found his employer described like an enemy.
Has it been personally hard for you the last couple of years
to be working as an American for this company that has been pushed upon by the United States in this way?
Well, it helps that the friends that I've maintained, and I've lost a few friends that are in government and former government people.
One friend he's lost in Washington used to coach Purdy's daughter on a basketball team.
He refused to have contacts with me anymore.
Purdy is trying to find out who will listen, as he argues that any risk of the Chinese government using Huawei can be contained.
We just like the opportunity to talk with the government about those proven risk mitigation mechanisms.
I'm interested in the way you're saying that. You say you'd like the opportunity. We're blocks from the White House. I presume that you and other people at Huawei have asked for a meeting. Are you not getting that meeting?
We have not been granted the meetings with the appropriate folks in government that we've requested. Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, there's a geopolitical overlay over the whole situation with the trade talks. And so the kinds of experts in government who would normally talk with us about these kinds of things, they don't want to stick their nose above the firing line to have those kinds of discussions.
Purdy argues that Western telecom firms can gain from buying Huawei equipment that is innovative and cheap.
Despite where we're headquartered, we can bring huge benefit to America.
But there really is a law that says that Chinese organizations and individuals must cooperate with intelligence gathering activities, and in fact, they'll be protected if they do.
Our experts say that that's not what the law says. And in fact, the U.S. government recently has admitted that they don't believe the law has any relevance whatsoever.
Although,
because they believe that a Chinese-based company would have to do whatever the China government says, regardless of a law.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's two things there. One is, I know that your lawyers have argued that China's constitution provides some protections for that. But you just alluded to the other argument. In China, maybe it doesn't matter what the law is. The government is very powerful, and they will ask for what they ask for.
That's the U.S. government position.
Purdy doesn't really dispute the U.S. objection. China's authoritarian government may well ask a company for help. Instead, he hopes to show that Huawei could not help China, even if asked. Networks can be built so they're harder to penetrate. And after Huawei sells hardware to telecom firms, Huawei has no free access to that equipment or to the data passing through.
The general principle is, if we don't have the data, nobody can force us to turn it over. That's the fundamental concept.
Let me ask about another risk that is raised by some experts, which is the notion that there might be some way in Huawei equipment to just shut it off, and that if told, Huawei could disrupt a network or shut down a network.
We believe that risk mitigation measures need to be in place to help make sure that the carriers and operators are not subject to being shut down. So, for example, the operators, they can segment segment the network so that if there's a successful penetration, the potential consequences, the potential shutdown, will be very, very limited.
This American who works for Huawei insists the technical challenges can be met. The political challenges? That may be another question as two giant nations begin to pull apart. We're hearing stories of people with a foot in two worlds. And this afternoon, we visit a Huawei campus in China, designed to look like cities in Europe. So now we're in Bologna, Italy, riding this little golf cart down the colonnade, past stone columns on either side. The tech giant's grand ambition set in stone. This afternoon on All Things Considered. This is NPR News.
A Justice Department report found Alabama's prisons have the highest homicide rate in the nation. One inmate in that system heard our coverage and wrote us a letter. He says inmates have never felt so unsafe.
He never just felt like our life being endangered the way it is today. Basically, everybody incarcerated feared in danger.
A view from inside Alabama's prisons this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A federal appeals court is considering whether to reverse a lower court's ruling involving a citizenship question the Trump administration seeks to add to the 2020 U.S. Census. As NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports, the lower court could put an additional block on the question.
The Trump administration is expected to formally respond today to plaintiffs in the Maryland lawsuits over the citizenship question, who have asked the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to review an issue that has not been argued before the Supreme Court. The 4th Circuit could ultimately decide that this question must be removed from the 2020 census because it was allegedly intended to discriminate against immigrant communities of color.
The Trump administration says the question will help to enforce the Voting Rights Act. President Trump will be in Iowa tomorrow, where voters have been hearing from many of the Democratic presidential contenders. Clay Masters with Iowa Public Radio says 19 Democratic White House hopefuls were campaigning there yesterday.
The biggest name not on the rundown of speakers was former Vice President Joe Biden. He came in first in a major Iowa poll over the weekend, followed by Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. They all spoke at the event in Cedar Rapids. Each candidate got 5 minutes to speak. The Iowa caucuses are the first contest in the presidential nominating process and are held in early February.
This is NPR News from Washington. 5% tariffs on U.S. imports from Mexico are on hold following a border security deal announced Friday by President Trump. Those tariffs were supposed to take effect today. Germany's foreign minister is in Iran, where he's working to salvage the 2015 nuclear agreement after President Trump withdrew the U.S. NPR's Peter Kenyon says Germany believes a European payment mechanism could soon be operational to allow trade with Iran to continue despite U.S. sanctions.
Foreign Minister Heiko Maas arrived in Tehran Sunday for talks with senior Iranian officials, and he says all the formal requirements for an alternative payment mechanism known as INSTEX are in place. His comments followed criticism by Iran's foreign ministry, which described European moves to keep trading with Iran as too little and too late. A foreign ministry spokesman said Europe has, quote, no will to resist the illegal demands of the United States, which reimposed sanctions on Iran after President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the nuclear deal. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
Police in the Dominican Republic say they don't know why a gunman shot and wounded former Boston Red Sox slugger David Ortiz last night at a bar in Santo Domingo. Ortiz was shot in the lower back. He underwent surgery and is expected to recover. Ortiz was known as Big Poppy during his Major League Baseball career. He was a 10-time All-Star who helped lead Boston to 3 World Series titles. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform, featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing, account registration, and more at zoom.us. And from Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. There are at least 2 places where Mexico can affect the flow of Central American migrants toward the United States. One, of course, is the U.S. southern border with Mexico. Another is at Mexico's southern border, which Central Americans must cross first. As part of a deal with the United States, Mexico has promised to send National Guard troops to its own southern border in an effort to cut down the flow. So what's happening there now? Independent reporter James Frederick joins us now from Tapachula, Mexico. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What's the border like?
Well, it depends on where you are. If you're at the actual border, which is a river that divides Mexico and Guatemala, There's absolutely no presence of security forces or anything right now, and it's basically always been this way. So I was there yesterday, and you see these inflatable rafts. They strap boards onto these rafts and then use them to ferry people and goods back and forth across the border. And okay. So while I was there, I watched several groups of migrants cross easily without a problem into Mexico.
Okay, so you can get into Mexico, but you said it depends on where you are. When people go a little farther into Mexico, does something else happen?
As you drive up highways here in southern Mexico, you will run into lots of immigration checkpoints. So I spent a couple hours at an immigration checkpoint that was about 30 minutes north of the border. It had immigration agents, police, and army there, and they were stopping every van and bus that came by and checking it for undocumented migrants. So in the hour or so I was there, they took about 20 people off buses, put them into armored migration vans, and took them to the local detention center.
Okay, so there is some border enforcement, some immigration enforcement there in southern Mexico now. What happens to the people that you saw being taken away?
Well, the most likely thing is that they're going to be deported. The vast majority of people who are detained by Mexican migration forces are sent to their home country. And I went to the detention center yesterday, and outside there, I met a Salvadoran woman named Maria Eugenia Medina, whose 18-year-old son had been detained by Mexican migration the day before. She fled an abusive husband from El Salvador. She made it to the U.S., but was deported. So she really knows her chances of getting into the U.S. are slim, but she doesn't feel good here in Mexico either.
Yo no quiero estar aquí porque acá anda mucho centroamericano de El Salvador, mucho de la pandilla.
So she says, I don't want to be here. There are lots of Central Americans, Salvadorans from the gangs here, and I worry one of them will come and kill my son. So she worries about gangs finding him here in Mexico, and she's having, you know, issues with Mexican migration. One son is detained right now. Another one of her sons has already been deported from here once. So, you know, with both Mexico and the U.S. cracking down hard on migrants, someone like Maria just feels like she and her children have nowhere to go.
I guess this was part of the negotiations between the U.S. and Mexico. The U.S. wanted Mexico to take in asylum seekers. Mexico said, actually, we're not safe enough for that. And I gather the U.S. backed down. So people can still ask for asylum in the U.S., right?
Yeah, people can ask for asylum both in Mexico and the U.S. I mean, it's just, it's really a matter of if people feel safe in Mexico. A lot of them do not. And can they even make it to the U.S.? And how hard is it if they do want to request asylum in the U.S.?
James Frederick, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
He's in southern Mexico.
It's Pride Month, and celebrations are happening all over the country. A lot of them also marking the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots, when New York police raided a gay bar. The patrons resisted, and a movement was born. Now there's a debate over whether to allow police officers in uniform to participate in Pride events. Sally Schilling from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento reports.
The Pride Parade featured rainbow flags, tutus, glitter, and off-duty police officers. Police Sergeant Michelle Gigante was one of at least a dozen of them who marched in Sacramento celebration yesterday.
So this is actually a really huge event for me as an out lesbian officer. It's a fantastic day, and I'm so happy that we're able to march in uniform.
Gigante almost wasn't allowed to wear her badge this year. 10 days ago, Sacramento Pride organizers decided to ban officers from participating in uniform to honor people who have been harmed by police. Ebony Harper is a transgender activist in Sacramento. She agreed with the decision. She says police sometimes assume that all transgender people are sex workers. It happened to her just a couple weeks ago.
I was stopped and asked for my ID, and I said, no, I'm not giving you my ID. And I said, I have a job, you know, I'm well known in this community, but, you know, he still didn't believe me.
Harper says there shouldn't even be a debate.
That uniform represents pain to our community. So it doesn't matter if you're a gay cop. If the law says to arrest another gay person, then that's your duty.
After some criticism, organizers and law enforcement came up with an agreement. Sacramento police offered to start an advisory committee focused on LGBTQ issues. After that, Pride leaders voted to allow the uniform again. Here's board president Carlos Marquez.
We believe the agreement that we were able to arrive at with the police department is fair and both reflects the point of view of those within our community who are the most marginalized and desperately deserve a platform upon which they can seek improvements within the police department.
This debate is happening in other cities. Organizers of New York's Pride took up the issue last year in anticipation of the Stonewall riots' anniversary. They voted to allow officers in uniform, saying Pride is a platform for free speech. Last week, New York's police commissioner formally apologized for the Stonewall raid. But some in Sacramento were still angered by the decision to allow the uniform again, particularly transgender people and people of color. Yesterday, about 100 people linked arms and blocked festival-goers from entering. Brianna Martin helped organize the protest.
What are you doing? You're killing black and brown folks. Same black and brown folks, they're queer and trans. I am queer and trans, and I'm a black person, and I know I'm at risk to die, and I don't want to be.
Gay police officers in the Sacramento parade felt like they were honoring the Stonewall memory, showing just how much things have evolved. But others in the LGBTQ community felt like this was their leaders giving into oppressive powers instead of, like at Stonewall, choosing to fight back. For NPR News, I'm Sally Schilling in Sacramento.
And later today on All Things Considered, will passengers be willing to fly in the 737 MAX planes if they're cleared after two fatal crashes? We'll hear from NPR listeners. You can listen to that story by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local member station by name. This is NPR News.
Lisa Mullins. There's a new Netflix series about the so-called Central Park Five. Five black teenagers wrongly convicted of raping and nearly killing a woman. They were coerced by police to confess.
Is my mom here?
She left.
She wasn't feeling well.
It's just us.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. As a teenager, I once was pulled over for driving far over the speed limit, but my excuse was not nearly as good as the one offered by a 16-year-old in Canada. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police clocked the speeding red Camaro at 170 kilometers per hour through Manitoba. That's about 105 miles per hour. The driver explained he'd eaten too many hot wings and really, really, really needed a bathroom. Despite this explanation, he was fined. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from TransferWise, which was built to make it easier to send money internationally. 4 million people and businesses use TransferWise to send, receive, and convert currencies in more than 70 countries. More at TransferWise.com. And from Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 43 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at JonesDay.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Some senators are trying to rein in the power of the president. Ultimate power may rest with Congress, but day to day the president acts while Congress struggles to react. Some senators now want to undo $8 billion in arms sales to Saudi Arabia and others. The administration bypassed Congress by declaring a national emergency. Here's NPR's David Wellner.
South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has a simple explanation for why he's helping lead the attempt to block the administration's emergency arms sales authorizations.
What happened in Saudi Arabia can't be condoned.
Graham has been a big supporter of President Trump, but he's been critical when it comes to the October murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a death Graham blames on Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known by his initials MBS.
I'm usually on the other side of this issue. I've been very supportive of arms sales to our partners throughout the world, including Saudi Arabia. But MBS behavior is a game changer.
Such major arms sales would normally require prior review by Congress, but not so under Trump's national emergency declaration.
We need the administration to recalibrate, take a step back, rescind its decision.
That's New Jersey Democratic Senator Robert Menendez. He's pushing 22 resolutions of disapproval in the Senate, one for each arms deal. Menendez put those deals on hold a year ago, citing reports of Saudi and Emirati warplanes bombing civilians in Yemen. The UN considers Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Menendez is well aware that should the disapproval resolutions pass the Senate, 67 votes would be needed to override a likely presidential veto.
I'm not sure that we can get there, but I think two things will have been made clear no matter what. One is that a bipartisan majority of the Senate disapproves of both the sales and the policy as it relates to what's happening in Yemen, the lack of action on the Khashoggi killing, and preserving the institutional prerogatives of the Senate in this regard as a check and balance with this or any other administration.
Trump, for his part, has consistently pushed for more weapons sales to Saudi Arabia. Speaking 2 weeks after the Khashoggi murder, Trump defended Saudi arms sales by dramatically overstating their value.
We have $450 billion worth of things ordered from a very rich country, Saudi Arabia. 600,000 jobs, maybe more than that.
In fact, industry experts estimate such sales would be worth just over $100 billion and generate at most 40,000 American jobs. And parts of the precision-guided bombs being sold to Saudi Arabia will be made there under a deal with arms manufacturer Raytheon. Democratic lawmakers had already expressed concern about the Trump administration's approving the transfer of nuclear know-how to Saudi Arabia. Tim Kaine is a Democratic senator from Virginia.
Why are they doing so many sweetheart deals with Saudi Arabia? What they are doing is escalating tensions in a very dangerous part of the world.
The House Foreign Affairs Committee is holding its own hearing this week on Trump's emergency decree for the arms sales. Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy expects such pushback will continue.
I have a sneaky suspicion one way or the other Congress is going to do something big on Saudi arms sales. Even if we can't get 67 for these resolutions, I think that appropriations bills are going to have some language restricting arms sales.
Earlier this year, Congress passed legislation that cut off all military aid for the war in Yemen, but that failed to overcome a presidential veto. The disapproval resolutions, should they pass, could well meet the same fate. David Wellner, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Every generation needs a good breakup song. Some are full of rage, some full of sadness. Swedish pop star Robin made a breakup song that became a millennial anthem full of energy and perseverance. It's the latest musical deep dive in our American Anthem series, and NPR's Sam Sanders is our guide.
From the start, Robin's Dancing on My Own reaches right into your soul and latches on. The song's about 118 beats per minute, a tempo engineered almost perfectly for human movement.
You know, it's right around where scientists have placed the preferred walking tempo.
That's Nate Sloan,
co-host of the podcast Switched on Pop and assistant professor of musicology at the University of Southern California.
Nate says what also makes this song special is that it's one big bait and switch. After the music starts all happy and dancey, Robin turns it around when she starts to sing. Somebody said she got a new friend. Does she love you better than I can? Somebody said you got a new friend. Does she love you better than I can? That's a breakup song. Nate Sloan says that puts Dancing on My Own right up there with a bunch of other classic sad songs that sound happy.
It's definitely got a long history in pop, like Mbop by Hanson.
Wait, that's a sad song?
That's a really sad song, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
In Dancing on My Own, Robin is at the same club as an ex-lover. On the same dance floor, she sees this ex dancing with another girl. I'm in the corner, watching you kiss. Chorus peaks with Robin accepting reality and dancing through the pain. This strange thing has happened with Dancing on My Own in the last few years. Every time I've seen people experiencing this song, a song with the words "on my own" in the title, they are not alone. Lena Dunham's character on HBO's Girls, she danced to Dancing on My Own in a scene of that show with her character's best friend. Lots of people told me about playing this song at wedding receptions to get everyone on the floor dancing and singing together. There's this one video on YouTube. It's got dozens of people on a subway platform in New York, all going home after a Robin concert, waiting for the train, and crammed together on the subway platform, they burst into song together, singing Dancing on My Own. Dancing on My Own was first released in the States in 2010. Years before this song, Robin was making light, fluffy teen pop. But Robin left that behind, made her own record label, changed up her look, and she began to make music that was edgier. In 2010, Robin told NPR about basically breaking up with a certain side of the music industry.
It was a big, big change for me, but I really didn't feel like I had another option. For me, it was like the last thing to try before I was going to quit music, kind of.
Sasha Geffen is a music critic, and she says even though Robin left teen pop behind, she still has teen pop in her DNA. And that's part of what makes the song Dancing on My Own work.
It's important to see her as a teenager who survived, right? She has kind of learned to carry the intensity of teenage emotion into perfectly adult pop songs.
Patrick Berger is a Swedish songwriter. He co-wrote and produced Dancing on My Own with Robin. He told me his favorite lyric in the song is this perfect example of that messy teenage emotion. Robin singing about being stubborn. Yeah, I know it's stupid, but just gotta see it for myself. Patrick Berger says lyrics like that make Dancing on My Own something different than those breakup songs where you're just tough and strong and everything's gonna be fine and you're great.
And you're not really being the smartest person on the planet. You're not being the nicest. You're not being, like, the best. You're just, like, you're just a loser. And that's fine, you know? You're lost.
Lost, but dancing through it. In researching this story, I heard from a Robin fan who had a particularly touching story about just that, being lost and using Dancing on My Own to dance through it. Her name is Nora.
I'm Nora McNerney. I'm a writer and a podcast host.
Her podcast is called Terrible, Thanks for Asking. Nora told me as soon as she met her boyfriend, Aaron, who became her husband.
He asked me basically right away, do you like Robin?
He made her listen to all things Robin. He was obsessed. Robin became a big part of their relationship. But a few years after the relationship began, it ended.
Aaron, 4 years after we met, he died of brain cancer.
And as he was dying, Aaron made Nora a playlist.
One of the songs that was on his funeral playlist was Dancing on My Own.
Nora obeyed his request, and she played Robin's Dancing on My Own at her husband's funeral.
There's that line where she says, the lights go out, the music dies. But you don't see me standing here, and I just came to say goodbye. And I do bawl at that part pretty regularly.
At the funeral, Nora did bawl, but she also danced.
It had thinned out. There were maybe 100 people left, and the music was playing, and I was very, very drunk. I would not recommend blacking out at your husband's funeral, but if you got to do it, I mean, if you must, and I remember singing that song and crying with my friends.
Nora says now, Dancing on My Own makes her think of all the times she'll get on dance floors with her son, Aaron's son, and dance with him. And that's really the reason Robin's Dancing on My Own is a true anthem. Because every time with this song, whenever you hear it, whenever you experience it, you immediately feel less alone. Sam Sanders, NPR News.
Sam is the host of the podcast It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Get yourself a Tita'sta Cafe and drop a quarter into La Lu Jukebox with me, your host, Blake Miller, right here on your favorite radio station, KRVS.
Every Saturday night at 6 and Sunday morning at 7 here on KRVS.
Well, everybody's heard about the bird.
Hi, this is Lee Klein, Peter, with an invite to join me for some music that stood the test of time from the 40s all the way up into the 70s. It's the music of the Old Gold Show coming up this Thursday at noontime on your public radio connection in Acadiana. That's 88.7 and also on the web at krvs.org. Lee Klein, Peter, Old Gold coming up noon Thursdays on KRVS.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette Lake Charles. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public.